Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Mary Cranston, who currently serves on the public boards of Visa, the Shermoors Company, and TPG. She previously served on the public boards of MyoKardia and McAfee Corporation. In addition, she serves or has served on several private and nonprofit boards. In December 2012, she retired as the firm's senior partner and chair emeritus of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, an international law firm based in San Francisco, where she served as a CEO between 1998 and 2006. In this podcast, we talk about her career as a lawyer and corporate director. We address diversity in law firms and boards, lawyers serving as corporate directors, and the evolution of shareholder engagement. Among other topics, we discuss ESG, shareholder and stakeholder governance, the current down cycle, and its impact on board service. We also address some of the distinctions between serving on public and private company boards, including private equity and venture-backed companies. If you like this show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Mary, it is so good to have you in the Boardroom Governance Podcast. Thank you so much for coming in. I've heard about you for such a long time. You're a legend in the legal career in San Francisco, and it's great to talk to you about this, and not only in a legal career, but also in the governance world. So we have a lot to discuss, but first, thanks so much for doing this.
Totally. It's my pleasure. I always enjoy particularly reaching out to the legal community about boards. Because not only do lawyers advise boards, but I think we need more lawyers on boards.
All right. Yeah, we'll go into that because that's a good question there. But first, let's talk about your origin story. Why don't you tell us where you were born, where you grew up, and we'll go from there a little bit in your career. I know you have a deep career, so we can't go through everything, but maybe we'll start from the beginning and we'll end up with governance.
Okay. Well, I was born at Stanford, at the Stanford Hospital. And my mom had come out to Stanford from the Midwest and met my father, who was a native Californian. And I have a twin sister, so we have journeyed this life together. I also have two other siblings. But I would say my twin has been a powerful influence on me, along with my mother. So my mom was quite a brilliant woman. But in the 1940s, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for women's careers. So She was the first woman hired by the Fed in Kansas City when she graduated from Stanford. And she had to quit when she got married. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that went on then. So she ran all the charitable organizations in town, but she was kind of a pit bull on women's careers. So she was always very supportive of me and my twin sister. And my twin sister is, in fact, the first board certified female vascular surgeon in the U.S. So we were both quite pioneers of the pioneer generation going into the workforce, which fortunately for us was just opening up for women. So I went to Stanford undergrad, Stanford Law School, and then I went to work for the, at that time, the largest and oldest San Francisco law firm, Pillsbury, Madison, and Sutro. And it was, it's a great firm with really wonderful human beings and a culture that is more accepting than some of women and ethnic minorities. I didn't realize that at the time because it was my world, but I've seen how different it was. And I think it was very lucky for me. It was the first law firm in the US to have a couple of women partners ahead of me. And again, that was a very unique and special opportunity for me.
And we should call out Toni Rembe, because I know her, you know, with Arthur Rock, they founded the Stanford Rock Center. So Toni Rembe is very dear and obviously a pioneer in her own way.
Yeah, she was an amazing mentor to me. And in fact, you know, probably the reason I've had the board career I've had is that Toni started talking to me about that when I was still fairly young. Many women didn't even see board work as a possibility. So it was helpful, definitely helpful. And so I went to Pillsbury and, you know, I really had a great time. I became a partner. And that's when I began to really what I would call hit a psychological wall. I actually thought before I became a partner that I would be thrilled for the rest of my life because that had been my goal for so long. And I became a partner and you know, it's kind of immediately, almost immediately, I sort of said, what's next? And I realized I had no vision for that because there were no women, you know, who'd been in that position in litigation, which was a different kind of a field. And so I started to really do a lot of work on myself. I started asking, what would I really like to do? And I became pretty clear that I wanted to be, because I could tell in the law firm that client control, rainmaking was the power, you know, modality for partners. So I started to say, well, I think I want to be a lead trial lawyer and in demand. And I looked around, there were no women anywhere in that field. So somehow or other, I got onto the notion of vision. I started picturing myself in this kind of a role. And so I set these goals for myself, you know, to be one of the biggest rainmakers in the firm and in demand. And I had no idea how I was going to do it, but I set the goal. And every day I would do what I would call baby steps in that direction. I could tell at a gut level whether something moved me closer or farther away. But the really big surprise was once I set these goals, which were outside of what the culture thought was appropriate or possible for women, mm-hmm. was the self-doubts that came up. And I really had to work with my head. You know, it told me, you're not going to be allowed to do this. What makes you think you're qualified to do this? Blah, 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 blah. And I just kind of ignored it and went for it anyway. And since then, I've done a lot of research and been very involved in the whole effort of women to get through the glass ceiling. And I realized that those thoughts in my head were simply cultural conditioning. And men and women carry the same cultural conditioning about what's possible for women. Men, with no malice at all, tend to underestimate what women are capable of. And women have a lot of self-doubt that men don't have, and they have to work through it. So it was quite a long journey and an eye-opener. Every day I took these baby steps for 5 years, and one day I woke up and I was a rainmaker. And I could tell then, it's sort of the energy went out of the balloon of being a famous trial lawyer. And I realized I had only really had that goal because I thought it would make me safe in the man's world. And at that point, I started to say, okay, at a deeper level, what do I want to do? And it was basically, how can I help in any situation? And that has continued to motivate me to this day. So when they asked me to become the chair and CEO of the firm, I wasn't expecting it. It kind of came out of the blue for me, but I said, okay, I think they need me to help, because they'd been struggling a bit with succession and they were kind of looking around for somebody else. And so I then became the chair and CEO of Pillsbury for 8 years. And I was the first woman ever to head one of these global 100 law firms. And immediately, of course, I got another round of self-doubts, which I handled in the same way, just ignored them and went on. And I had a great female managing partner as well. So after several terms of this, I thought it was time to do a transition. I think, you know, the CEO, effective CEOs tend to stick around for 5 to 10 years.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so that's when I started my board career. While at the firm and while chairing the firm, I did have one board. And then when I stepped down from that, I started to fill out the board portfolio. And so for 15 years, I've been on a number of public company and private boards. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
Why don't you tell us about, you know, that transition? Because not every partner of a law firm serves, in fact, very few serve on boards. And I think, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about Tony Renby, because Tony Renby has been so active in the board herself, in the board corporate governance world. But what made you take this leap into boards, and how has that evolved with your post-legal career?
You know, I went into law in part because the business schools weren't yet open. And I was indifferent as to whether it was law or business. I didn't really honestly understand the difference that much. But as I went along, I became aware that I am much more interested in the big picture board, big picture business strategy world than in legal. I can do both, but my more intrinsic interest is there. So as I was being the chair and CEO of the firm, and I was on one board that Tony helped me get, I began to realize that when I stepped down as the CEO, I didn't want to really go back into practicing law. I'd rather go and be on a bunch of boards. So that part was sort of obvious to me internally. The complicating thing was that boards have prejudice against putting lawyers on boards. They think generally that they can hire that expertise. And why do you want to, you know, issue spotting board member and just dragging everybody down in the boardroom? I think that's extremely wrong and it's extremely short-sighted, but that's sort of the culture out there. I was an 8-year CEO, and they boards were really looking for female CEOs at that time. It turned out that that was the plus factor that gave me a lot of board opportunities. Mm-hmm. Since then, I've noticed that a lot of boards, particularly in complex regulated industries or companies that have a lot of litigation complexity, are more open to having a lawyer on the board. And generally, those lawyers are considered to be extremely valuable participants because, in general, that kind of lawyer is often quite strategic in their thinking, but they also have an ability to kind of look around the corner and see what the problems might be and then come up with solutions as opposed to just identifying the problem. So I think we're starting to see a real trend to seeing more lawyers on boards, but the lawyers are going to have to go an alternate route. The headhunters are still not very open to it. So you have to use your networks. And that's the name of the game. And there's a number of initiatives. The ABA and Catalyst have something called Direct Women, which takes senior women lawyers, puts them through some training and gives them extra help in getting their first board. And that's been pretty effective. So I think things are changing.
All right. Well, that's really interesting. Before we jump into full governance, let me ask you, you've been considered like a pioneer in gender diversity in law firms. Have you seen much change in law firms in this regard? And how much has it changed, if at all?
Well, you know, I became the chair of Pillsbury in 1999. And when I stepped down, you know, 9 years later, I was 50 years old. I thought we're just getting to the point where my generation of pioneer women into the profession are hitting the age where they would be selected for top leadership. But when I stepped down, there was only one other person in that role. So it didn't happen as quickly as I thought. Now there are a number of major law firms headed by women. So that has opened up a bit. And I know that the number of graduates coming out of law school are probably a little more than 50-50. And so law firms have had to adjust to try to make sure that their environment is, you know, attractive to women. That said, I do think law firms in general are a little behind industry. And my own interpretation of why that is that large business has started to realize that they can't compete over the long haul without really being able to tap the entire talent market. And also it's becoming clearer and clearer that firms that are diverse at the top outperform firms that are not. You need to have servant leadership also, but diverse firms with servant leadership outperform other organizations, similar organizations. So business has gotten quite serious about dealing with unconscious bias and helping people see it and do things that really help. Law firms, as smaller organizations generally, have less budget for this kind of stuff, and it's been slower, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And so I think I see progress, but probably not as fast as the most enlightened corporate environments.
Mm. Interesting. You know, if we switch to boardroom diversity, that's where maybe in the last 5 years or so, there's been a lot of change pushed by institutional investors, maybe some regulators. Some states like California passed laws like AB 979 or SB 826, which was based on gender and minorities. NASDAQ is you know, pushing a new rule as well on diversity on boards. The laws in California have been challenged. It's not clear whether they will succeed. But give us your take, because this has happened while you've been on board. So I'm sure you have a lot of takes on...
have an opinion.
on this board evolution, because it has changed, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be really straight with you. I think in America, we have a cultural norm against quotas. And in general, you know, I kind of agree with it. However, the lack of progress on diversity throughout most of my board career suggests that there is strong systemic bias that makes it tougher. And when you look at what happened in Europe, putting those quotas in, and in Britain using some very strong It wasn't a quota, but there was a strong regulatory push for it. And the amount of improvement in diversity on those boards is hard to argue with. So I was actually happy to see the California law come through. It's probably not going to survive, but it did have an incredible immediate impact on the diversity of boards. And I'm seeing in the boardroom huge amounts of attention now to this in a way that wasn't there before. I would say before there was sort of a unconscious thought that if you got up to three women on a board, you were in a safe harbor and you didn't have to think about it anymore. And you could go back to putting, quote, the most qualified person on the board, which tended to be a white male CEO. But of course, the CEO ranks are the most biased pool there is. But since these changes happened in California, particularly for underrepresented minorities, I've seen a huge push. And of course, for women of color, which was the most underrepresented group, it's been great because, in a sense, they're a twofer for the board. And so there's been some great opportunity there. And this is all alongside of the fact that the statistical correlation between diversity on the boards and actually diversity in the C-suite as well and performance is now very strong. So I think we've crossed a threshold. My own experience in the boardroom is that most of the successful women directors of my generation are very skilled at being heard in an all-male environment. And it is an act and it is a set of skills that we teach young women to be more successful. Once you get three women in the boardroom, that becomes less of a problem because the gender shift has occurred and there's enough female voices. And also women are very skilled at saying, you know, I think that was the point that, you know, Rosa just made, you know, as when it's attempted to be sabotaged by unconscious men in the room. And so the three women in the boardroom makes a huge difference. And then for a long time, women were in the boardroom, but were not making their way up into the leadership ranks, especially nom-gov chair or board chair. And that is really starting to change. And women in charge of the nom-gov function and the comp function not only help a lot with the board diversity and the leadership and the getting the most out of diversity because it becomes a more inclusive culture in the boardroom, but they also are much more likely to look down the leadership ranks, the succession ranks, to see if women are actually getting a fair shot coming up the pipeline into the top jobs. So it has quite an impact.
Yeah.
And until you get to that critical mass, you know, women just have to spend too much energy just being heard.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And we'll talk a little bit about the distinctions later on public boards and private boards, because there are differences and also on diversity and composition that we can address. But let me ask you before that, how have you seen governance evolve in the last 14, maybe 15 or 20 years since you've been on boards? The shareholder engagement has become much more important. Institutional investors have become way bigger, right? We've got BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street that have so much power now that they're actually giving some of this voting power back to beneficial owners or others because of the political pushback. But, you know, there's also activist investors that have become very prominent, shareholder proposals and proxy advisors. So maybe what has been your experience thinking from the shareholder base, the evolution of governance? And we're talking now on public companies and not private companies.
Right. Well, I would say that starting with Dodd-Frank, there's just been a huge shift in the amount of power given to board members to actually oversee the company. And then the external pressure from investors, activists, and the various people who monitor boards has really shifted the amount of oversight that boards feel that they are
maybe
required
you meant
to give.
Sarbanes-Oxley before Dodd-Frank?
What did I say? I said Dodd-Frank. Yeah. Sarbanes-Oxley. Exactly. And so the boards have become, in my experience, much more self-aware of what they owe the shareholders and spend a lot more time on it. It used to be that boards were, I think before that, kind of a they certainly knew their duties and they were trying to do it, but it was more of a club. And we'd try to keep everything in the family and do the right thing for the shareholders, but The CEO had probably an inordinate amount of power in that mix, including picking the board members. And that has really changed. And I think there's certainly a lot more director education now. Now, in terms of how much influence all this has, I think once a board wakes up and starts to do its job correctly, the externals are they're there, but they're not as much of an immediate forcing of action because the board is already doing what it needs to do. The board always knows more than even the activist shareholders or anybody out there. And as long as they're doing the right job and the company continues to thrive and develop, all is well. If the company starts to really fall off in performance and the board isn't up to taking the action it needs to correct things, that's when the activists start to make a difference. So it is a different environment. I think it's much healthier. And, you know, as a board member, I like it. I think it it makes it clear to me as a director that I need to exercise my best independent judgment and get it out there. And it gives me the backbone always to do that.
You know, this makes me think about the Business Roundtable restatement of the purpose of the corporation 2019, when they said that the purpose of the corporation is not only to benefit the shareholders, but now it's to benefit all the stakeholders. And they put in there, right, the environment, the employees, the, you know, all the other, you know, customers, supply chain. Has this changed your role or duties in the board? Like, what has changed since then? Was it more, you know, maybe a press symbolic issue? Have boards always think about, you know, the stakeholders? I realize that this is not the pattern in Delaware law, right? Like, you know, they give you a lot of leeway to make decisions to maybe make better employees or pay more employees or do some stuff that are better for the customer, but ultimately always to the benefit of the shareholders. But there's been a reinvigoration of this debate that has existed, you know, in the 70s and the 50s and the 30s, right? So it's not a new debate, but I'm curious on what is your take since you are serving on boards today?
Yeah, I've always thought this was a little bit of a circular tempest in a teapot because in my mind, the company needs to be run for the medium to long term best interest of the shareholders. So that's kind of the standard. So how do you get to the best interests of the shareholders in the medium and long term? Well, if you screw your employees, that's not so good for the long term, medium term. If you don't comply with evolving environmental thinking, that may not be so good. You're going to end up with a, you know, class action litigation out the yin yang for many years. I mean, so I do think that all of these different constituencies and interests need to be considered in determining what is the best medium and long-term interest of the shareholders. Because it's a complex calculation, it's really easy for people to go off on one direction or another and start pounding the table that this is, needs to be considered or doesn't need to be considered. One of the reasons I like a good, balanced, wise board is that these things are considered at a deep level and not at some kind of political, ideological bent one way or the other.
Well, you know, that also leads us to the new environment that is now called ESG, right? Environmental, yeah. Social governance, right? And somehow, there's always been environmental concerns. There's always been social issues, but now we have an acronym that puts everything together. And there's been a lot of push also from funds to invest in ESG, on companies to think about sustainability and other issues. Now, interestingly, there's been a pushback in the last maybe 6 months, anti-ESG, and it's become incredibly politicized. And states are taking back money from BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street and other asset managers or institutional investors who are pushing an ESG agenda. What do you make out of all of this ESG thing?
Well, I think anything can get politicized in our country in this day and age. You know, it's too bad in a way. Mm. But I think the ESG direction is appropriate. I know that the younger generation wants to know what its company's policies are in ESG, so it's important for talent recruitment and retention. It's also important for the long-term strategic direction of the companies. If you don't have ESG front and center, board members don't have all the information that they need in order to determine what's the wisest strategy. And as I said earlier, for example, if you have a company that decides it wants to skirt environmental regulation or wants to push back on it, and you continue to emit and things get worse and the regulation gets tighter, you're just buying yourself a lot of litigation. So I think it's simply calling out something that in today's world, companies need to spend a lot of time and attention on, because it's not only what your environmental decisions will mean for today, but for tomorrow. And all companies who are awake at the switch are considering it. And I think it's simply a clearer case of communication to the shareholders. Mm-hmm. That gives the shareholders the ability to buy or sell shares. If they don't like the environmental direction, they can sell their shares.
Yeah. And talking about shareholders and the market in general, this year, it's been a down market, very, very heavy down market. Valuations of tech companies in the public markets have gone down, I don't know, an average of 60%. In the private markets, which lag a little bit, also, there's going to be a lot of markdowns. There's going to, you know, probably be a lot of down round valuations. What do you make out of this in terms of the board and how to think of, as a director in this environment where I always say that governance really matters when things are going hard, right? When you have to make hard choices. For the last 10, 12 years, we were in a bull market. You know, stock prices were great. You know, companies were doing great. So that governance didn't really matter that much, as everybody was happy. Shareholders were happy. Employees were happy. But now we're going into an environment where maybe things are going to get much hairier and directors have to make much tougher decisions. We're seeing, I think, 106,000 layoffs in the tech industry. It's very, very tough environment. So why don't we talk about this from a board perspective and how to think about this down round or down cycle, sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, it was one of the longest bull markets in history. And I think we're seeing a pretty dramatic correction right now. And I think we've been through it before. What I think what boards need to do, of course, is work with the executive team to make sure we have a down market strategy. It would be a board pretty asleep at the switch if they weren't looking at that. And in the boardroom, they're looking at what these, let's just say the tech industry. I assume in these boardrooms, they're looking at what the short and long-term implications of the cuts are, what changes in strategic direction the company needs to make. And so I think in some ways, I see the down market sometimes as an opportunity to make sure that you have the right executives and succession plan, because in some ways it is more complicated for the executive team. You want to see how they are able to pivot and execute, particularly when they need to make a quick change in order to preserve medium-term results, particularly. And so it's a great crucible. So it's an opportunity. And I think it's a rare board that's going to throw the executive team over the side of the boat just because the external market is so difficult. And so it's up to the executive team to communicate clearly to the board what is exogenous, what they have control of, and how they're handling it, and what the implications are going to be. And that, you know, then the board does its duty and, you know, ask questions, yay or nay. Do we have the right team? Do we have the right executive?
Yeah, this reminds me actually that there was a news this morning that Ford, the CEO of Ford, just came out and said that electric vehicles will demand less employees, less labor, about 40% less labor.
Yeah.
About a month ago or more, the CEO of Volkswagen said the same thing and said that maybe there had to be 30,000 people laid off, and the cost of his job, because in Germany, you have a supervisory board where the majority of that supervisory board are employees. And so the labor force is very different. And so there's also a lot of questions in the transition. For example, the energy transition, there's going to be very important where companies will have to make these big decisions. And that's where maybe the board plays a big role. And sometimes some systems operate differently, right? Different to be in a board and on a company in Germany or in the United States. And some, you know, I don't know, Elon comes into Twitter and, you know, lays off half the people. I mean, that I'm not sure many other places would tolerate something like that.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not even sure Twitter is going to tolerate that. We'll see how it all plays out. But I think the supervisory boards in Europe do play a significant role in protecting labor. And it's, it has its pluses and minuses. And I think certainly one of the reasons why internationally everybody wants to invest in the United States is that we can move capital more quickly. We don't have as many constraints. If the board decides that it needs to lay people off, you can do it, subject to state laws, but it's certainly not the same thing as in Europe. So, you know, different strokes for different folks. I think it's a mistake, though, to think that American boards aren't very concerned about the impact on the labor markets of these decisions. And so the fact that they're doing it means that they're seeing, to me, it says that they're seeing this as a more systemic, longer term problem. I do think many industries, auto included, as technology evolves, have a reduced need for human labor. But other industries are emerging. You know, I think we're going to have many years of infrastructure build on all the new technologies for energy. And so there'll just be shifts in the labor market. Mm-hmm. And I do think the American system is a little more flexible for that and maybe the better one, honestly. Hmm.
That's interesting. You know, the other component that has been very clear in the United States is this divide at some level of private companies and public companies. And we've seen the emergence of what people have referred to as unicorns that are private companies valued at over $1 billion. They were called unicorns because they were rare at the beginning, right? But now we see a huge class of unicorns, about, you know, 1,200 globally. Valuation is about $4 trillion. Questionable, right? The valuation of these companies, it's not clear. But the SEC and other regulators have said these companies that in other times would have been public now are staying private. And very large companies with tens of thousands of employees, with billions of dollars in investment, and some companies may be opting not to go public, to be, and this is creating kind of a decision, maybe some type of arbitrage where you can be less regulated and you can operate under less supervision. What do you think about this divide of private companies versus public companies? And we should say that the private market has become much bigger than the public market for a long time now. So is this a change in how companies operate? And what are your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, well, I think there is a big cost to being a public company in terms of the scrutiny, kind of the hassle from shareholders, just a lot of the regulatory overhang that you have to do in a public company that you don't have to do in a private company. And so I think there is probably a fairly legitimate bias against going public now. It's an exit strategy for some of the private companies. And so there's no desire for it to go away, but it is the more expensive way to run governance. Now, I sit on both kinds of boards. The private companies do have boards who have fiduciary duties to their owners, the shareholders. My experience with it is that there is the same kind of discipline on strategy. Do you have the right leadership? Maybe even faster action on the private boards. And the boards tend to be smaller. They focus more on the business and less on all the regulatory check the box stuff you have to do in the public companies. So in some ways, they're more efficient. And I think we've got to be clear whether some of our regulation in the public markets is worth the candle. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of stuff you have to do that's very expensive that may or may not be that useful. And until that's kind of remedied, I think there will continue to be a growth in the private companies. And, you know, if you think about the whole private equity marketplace, there's these companies thrive on buying underperforming companies, either out of the public markets or from some other owner, and doing a lot of work on the company in a fairly short period of time and turning them around. That's probably good for the economy as a whole. Again, it's probably something easier to do in America because we have less labor regulations and stuff like that that allows the turnover to happen. And so I personally think it's a pretty good balance, and that we, as the American economy, to be the dominant force we've been in the world, need both. And it's one of the differentiators of the American economy. So I think it's a good thing. Okay. And I also don't think that the governance, now there are private companies that may have weak governance and there is not the same kind of, outside oversight. But my experience with it is for the bigger private equity companies, they know the power of good governance and they want it. So they have independent boards.
So one of the things that I tend to talk about is the distinction between a board and a public company, which tends to be 75-80% independent directors, you know, typically 9 board members, 8 of them independent directors and the CEO. If you go into a venture-backed company, it's typically the other way around, right? You may have 2 or 3 VCs, 2 or 3 founders, and maybe 1 or 2 independent directors. Very different board. Now, private equity is, again, very different because the private equity investors take control of a company, have 1 or 2 partners, have operating executives, have very different incentive structures. People don't talk enough about how private equity boards operate. People know about how venture capital boards operate, but private equity is like a very structured way and different way on running boards. There's a professor at Stanford, you know him, of course, Ron Gilson, wrote a paper, Board 3.0, about this idea of governance in a private equity. But you serve on a board of TPG, right? So basically, people have to understand.
I sit on the board of TPG as an entity, and then I also have sat on a couple of their portfolio boards.
Yeah, there you go. So even better. So you know how they operate in the portfolio company. So can you give us a few distinctions in as a board member, one of the portfolio companies of a private equity firm versus public company, and how to think about that?
In both cases, my job is to, as an independent director, because that's my status on all of these boards, is to be thinking about the shareholder and about how to deliver the best medium to long-term optimization for the shareholder, taking account of all these other factors that are complicated in business. And so in the public context, the shareholders are very diffuse. Your judgment includes what's the best for that shareholder without even really asking that shareholder what they think, because it's just too diffuse. In the private equity world, the shareholder is obvious and it's right there. And my job as a independent director is sometimes it's a complicated structure where there's more than one company and one of ownership company, and one of them is the dominant one. And then as an independent director, you're looking at minority abuse kind of issues as well. But in general, it's pretty clear what the shareholder wants. And as long as there's not some other governance problem with it, then, you know, you can kind of relax on that side and use your best judgment to help get the company situated optimally with your independent perspective on their strategy and on their executive team and all, et cetera. So in some ways it's a slightly easier job, I think. But it really is fundamentally the same territory. Mm-hmm. In the public company space, you also have a lot of regulatory oversight, which is very, very expensive. And, you know, it's kind of, there's so many layers of it that I'm thinking it's a bit overdone. You know, we have, for just example, on the accounting side, we have independent outside auditors whose whole reputation depends on whether they are accurate and really spot problems and bring it forward. And then we have the PCAOB, which is another layer looking at the independent auditors. To me, it's like, that's very expensive for the government. What's it really adding? You know, not that much. So I think committee chairs have to worry about if they make a certain kind of decision that really may be in the best interest of the company, but ISS and Glass Lewis have some arbitrary rule and they start to recommend voting against the committee chairman. There's just another layer of oversight that probably in some number of cases is helpful, but in a lot is just sort of a waste.
Yeah. You know, you made me think as well of at least on the press and a lot of people talk about this. One of the issues that people criticize of private companies or startups that have a lot of venture is having founders with dual class shares and having empowered founders. And, you know, this has become not only an issue in the private markets, but when these companies have gone public, like Google, after Google in 2004, most of these tech companies have had dual class shares. And it has made, for example, Snap, right, went public with non-voting shares, right? And that, you can imagine how all the large institutional investors push back on that. But any thoughts on that aspect of governance that is very specific to governance? But I should also say that it depends
company per company, because you can structure this very differently with, you know, maybe sunset provision, maybe it has a time sunset, or maybe it's got some other condition in there. So any thoughts on founder-led companies or dual class shares in general?
Yeah, well, in generally, those kind of situations, you do have public shareholders in the mix. And then there's another chunk of shares that are controlled. So that is a role where there's a lot asked of the independent directors. It's a complicated role. And your primary responsibility is to make sure that the public shareholders are not, there's no adverse action to the public shareholders' interests. And that can put you up against the founders in the boardroom, but that's kind of your job as an independent director. So I think it's the most complicated of the scenarios. On the other hand, when people buy those shares in the market, I always think you have to know what you're buying. And
right. Some people like it, right? Like some people,
absolutely. That may be their only way to get into that particular gravy train, and they're prepared to do it. Mm-hmm. Particularly if they are, I think, you know, you do rely in that situation on the independent directors in the mix to make sure, or to call out, or to quit the board if anything is going on that's truly going to disadvantage the public shareholders.
Okay. Well, you know, I know we could keep on going and many issues on governance, but any final thoughts for current directors or people seeking to join boards?
Yeah, I do think lawyers are often phenomenal directors for a couple of reasons. One is because of our careers, we tend to have seen a number of different industries. We've been in boardrooms a lot. We're also in a profession where you don't lead by command and control. You have to do it by persuasion, which is also a board skill. Board work is a team sport. Anyone who's too domineering or too opinionated is often dysfunctional in a boardroom, because you have to listen well. And if everybody listens and has an open mind, usually a deeper wisdom will start to emerge. Lawyers are actually very good at that. And the best lawyers are excellent problem spotters, but always because they want to get to a solution. And they often, because of their experience, have seen a lot of, probably more than executives in a company or in an industry, a lot of different solutions to the kinds of problems that come up in every industry. So I think a good strategic lawyer should be a requirement on every board, but that's not how the board world sees it. So that means that headhunters, once in a while you get a board spec that does require legal expertise, but that's probably about 10% of the specs. Mm-hmm. And the headhunters will go look for lawyers in that context, but otherwise they probably won't. So what lawyers have to do who want to be on boards is to kind of think through their resume and reformat it to highlight the things they've done that would be really attractive to boards. So it's actually, you're assumed to be a governance expert. So you don't want to lead with that. You want to lead with transformation work that you've done, complex transactions that you've been involved in, et cetera. And then you start to build a network, and you start to let people know that you'd be interested in serving on a board. So I often suggest that people sit down with their contacts and just go through it and write down everybody they know that is on a board or around boards. And then think of some boards that you might be interested in and do a LinkedIn search for who's on the board and who are the directors, to see how you can get opportunities to talk to some of those people. And then when you get a nibble, you do your lawyerly thing, you read the entire set of SEC documents to get an idea of what the current issues are. And then you think through all the things you've done that might be relevant. If you were in the boardroom with that company, with that array of problems, what in your past experience would really be helpful to bring up? You do that kind of background. And then when you have an opportunity to interview, again, as a good lawyer, you ask questions, what's really worrying you? And you kind of offer your expertise so that you demonstrate in that interview that not only will you not be a pain in the boardroom, but you'll be kind of a unique set of perspectives. Works like a charm, but it takes a lot of prep work.
Well, that was great. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening will appreciate that advice. Let's switch into the rapid fire questions. What are the 1-3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
One is Good to Great by Jim Collins. Mm. As a a lawyer, I really didn't have a lot of background in business and training, but that book, it was his research on CEOs that lasted through several successions and where the company continued to do really well above the market through succession and what the characteristics of those executives were. And it was really illuminating. It wasn't the alpha dogs. It was, the steady servant leader types. So I was, that's one. And then another one was, I spent a lot of time in order to be a successful woman in an industries dominated by non-women. I had to really work with my own head a lot. And so I've spent a lot of time. One book that I found really useful early on was Start Where You Are by Pema Chodron. She's a Buddhist. To help you really get a handle on what your head is telling you that may or may not be true. And, you know, and making decisions based on that self-awareness.
All right. Well, those are great recommendations. Who are your mentors and what did you learn from them?
I'd say probably the most important were my mother and my sister, because from an early age, they were extremely helpful. And it's a lot of women would have mothers who would be a little nervous about what their daughters were doing. Not my mother, you know, she was pushing it all the time. Then I would say Tony Rembe and Margaret Gill, the two women partners at Pillsbury, ahead of me. They were very different styles and they weren't in litigation, but they were incredibly giving and helpful to me and remain some of my best friends.
All right, great. Are there any quotes you think of often or live your life by?
Yeah. Don't believe your thoughts until you really look at them.
All right. What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
You know, at the time I took it up, it was very unusual. And it's very tied into this notion of being able to really figure your head out. And that is meditation. So I've been doing it for 40 years. And of course, now everybody says it's good for your health and everything else. But it really helped me see what a thought was, get them isolated, start to look at them.
So I'm curious, would you do it in the morning, at night? When I mean, you were in a busy career.
Yeah, it's a good question. I realized that, especially when my kids were young and stuff, I just had no time. So I would get up a half hour earlier than I otherwise would. And that's when I would do it. And I actually found that half hour of meditation better than an extra half hour of sleep in terms of kind of setting me up for the day.
All right. No, that's great. Final question. Which living person do you most admire?
I'm just going to say it's a group. It's the women who were the first into their professions, you know, my twin sister, myself, so many of my women friends, and we relied on each other as kind of a support group. And it was very difficult because not much was known about unconscious bias. It, you know, it was like an 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody could see, feel, or touch. And it was all of us working together that I think allowed us to have the success we've had. And, you know, it's still a significant issue out there, but we know so much more about it. I think, you know, in a couple of years, maybe 10 years from now, we will have critical mass at all levels and it will sort of disappear.
Mary, thank you so much for doing this with me. It's been great to talk to you, to learn about your career, learn about your governance experience, and hopefully one day maybe we'll meet in the city or somewhere. And thanks again.
Sure, my pleasure, and good luck with your program.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.